Thanks for listening to Marketing B2B Tech, the podcast from Napier, where you can find out what really works in B2B marketing today. Welcome to Marketing B2B Technology, the podcast from Napier. Today, I'm joined by Emir Zekovic. Emir is currently in transition as we record, so he has been working at TechScrid, but now he is moving across to a new position at OpenGraph. So we're going to have an interesting conversation with him about how to market B2B technology products. Welcome to the podcast, Emir.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have you on. So, I mean, obviously your career is in a bit of transition, but can you just tell us, you know, how you got to this point now in your career?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting start. So probably you saw on LinkedIn, I was born in Skopje, North Macedonia. Honestly, nothing about the background was, nothing hinted that I would be interested in marketing, just how it happened. I started studying and got interested about when I was 20, and then started doing freelance work and it got very interesting. And somehow, I don't even know how I got involved with 12Min, which I'm also there as the CMO. The 12Min actually was founded by Diego Gomez, who is currently the founder of Rock Content, the biggest B2B SaaS company in all of Latin America. Somehow got promoted to the chief marketing role after 3 years, if I'm not wrong. And it just took from there. Meanwhile, I studied for, I actually got my master's degree from University of Sheffield. Actually, I didn't travel to the UK for that because they have international faculty presence in almost, if I'm not wrong, in Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, and Romania, but maybe I'm wrong for some of the countries. And I don't want to dwell too much on that because at the end of the day, it's more like practice. I don't think that the formal education had a huge role or anything of the kind, but it was a great experience. Actually, I learned a lot, while at Sheffield specifically. And right now I'm here. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. I always like to work at two places. Someone, I love B2C and I love B2B. So that's why I currently have kind of like two roles. It's fun. I don't know why else would I do it. Definitely fun.
That's awesome. I mean, you mentioned 12Min. So let's just, you know, look at that for a minute. As I understand it, that's a bit like Blinkist, which might be a more well-known brand name to our listeners, because I think our listeners are generally North America and Europe. But tell me a little bit about 12Min.
Yeah. Actually, we are direct competitors of Blinkist. We kind of started at the same time. From what I know, Blinkist currently is more focused on US and Germany, while we are more focused on South America and Central America, also expanding. We have US presence, which is growing. It actually was founded in 2017 early, like I said, by Diego Gomez, who is also the founder of Rock Content, a huge company, a very successful one. And it kind of, I believe he was looking for ways to read a lot of books, which sounds a bit of cliche, but that's exactly how he got the idea. And at that time, he couldn't find anything in Portuguese or in Spanish. So he thought, okay, maybe this will be a good idea. I don't know if at that time Blinkist was already established. I think yes, if I'm not mistaken. But 12Min started primarily for the Brazilian market and then moved to Spanish and got to English. And now even our English base is expanding. And we're also looking there to go into B2B, which is also very possible, and it requires a different set of strategy altogether. It's very different than just selling high ticket software compared to thousands of subscriptions. And I don't know if you know, but the average subscription price on the stores is $40. So you cannot go super high. Like I would say that the top markup that you can sell in countries like Singapore or the US, which are, let's say, more prosperous, it's $70 to $80 max, and you have to be very careful what you're doing, developing countries and so on. It really depends on the market.
That's fascinating. And I think, you know, it highlights something that perhaps people like myself who come from an English-speaking country, sometimes we're, you know, not so aware of what's going on in other countries, particularly if it's not an English language product. And certainly South America is a gigantic market and I think all too often overlooked.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'll just give you an insight. Do you know the average cost per click? I mean, the difference is 10 to 1 compared to the US and sometimes even 15 to 1. And if you compare, and Great Britain, it's, in my opinion, it's even more expensive than the US for some industries. So you can compare that. If you have a conversion rate that's 2 times less than what you have in first world countries, so anything from Germany to the UK or US, you can make a ton of money, and the profit margin is much greater, actually, even though it sounds counterintuitive, but the sheer competition in the US, for example, it's crazy. You get high conversion rates, but you also get a good lifetime value, whether you're going into B2B, B2C, but the acquisition cost for both of them are super high. Like, I remember when we were running ads for TextGrid for classic comparison-based landing pages with highest, okay, and someone might disagree, but they're one of the best converting landing page models out there, without a doubt, at least in my experience. The average cost per click was $20. If you do the same thing in Brazil, it's between $0.5 and $1. And the conversion rates are somewhat similar, with the US having 2-to-1 advantage. Now, of course, your order value, if you're running an e-commerce shop or you're providing service of any kind, it's going to be lower. You cannot charge the same rates. But just the very fact that it's 20 times cheaper to advertise, it already gives you a huge advantage. So you can adjust the price to fit the market, of course, but the advertising cost allow you room to lower your service fees, or I don't know, whatever you're selling, like e-commerce or even a software. So it's an advantage, especially Brazil with 200 million people.
That's a great point. I mean, I love that. I think trying to be as international as possible in a business is always a good idea, and don't underestimate countries maybe that you're not familiar with.
Yeah, absolutely. And India also, it's a huge market. I think everybody who misses out on India, especially, or Bangladesh, it's missing out on a lot. Good conversion rates, very low cost per 1,000 impressions for both Facebook and Google Ads, or anything else for that matter.
Yeah, and that's a great point too. I think, you know, there are other markets that perhaps people tend to underestimate. I'd like to move on to where you're going to. So you're moving to Open Graph. I'm not sure that, you know, all our listeners will be familiar with that company. So can you just briefly describe what the company does?
Yeah, I don't know if they're familiar with the Open Graph meta tags, which were built in the early 2010s. Well, I was still in high school, but it allowed that preview function of sharing information. Like, for example, if you wanted to share an article on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, it gave that metadata. It just extracts the metadata from a website or from a link, and it just made things a lot easier. So you can scrape the web, you can do all sorts of things in a much more efficient way than, I don't know, than if you tried any alternative use to it. But if they Google, for example, what's an Open Graph meta tag, they'll understand just by the preview of how it would look if you remove the meta tags of a link or of a website. So Open Graph does that.
That makes sense. And I think, you know, we probably don't need to dig too deep into exactly what the company does. What I'm really interested in, as you as a you know, marketing executive going in and looking to drive the marketing strategy, when you start at a company, or when you look at a new year, I mean, how do you approach building a marketing plan as a CMO?
I think the first thing that, for example, I never heard anyone say this, especially not in marketing school and not even at Sheffield, that you have to be data obsessed. And I don't mean data driven, which is kind of like cliche. I mean, literally obsessed with it. We always use this analogy. It's like being lost in the Amazon forest. And unless you know where you're going, you better not move anywhere. You better stay where you are. So the price you might pay if you don't know where exactly are you going is higher than if you just stay where you are. So the first thing that I always do is I obsessively analyze the data. And by that, I don't mean just the marketing data. I mean the business data. So you have how many touch points to conversions? What's the average life cycle? Well, how many months, days, weeks does it take for a product qualified lead to get to a sales qualified position, from a sales qualified to actually become a client? And I'm trying to find patterns where exactly, where is the elephant in the room? So for example, if you were to Google Open Graph, you would notice that, you cannot find this data, but I'm saying the traffic, like most of the traffic is driven through ads. So you have definitely a problem in the top of the funnel. it's very clear. So you have huge opportunity there. Next, you can move on, and then you think about how the life cycle goes. What's the conversion rate on the page? What actually, if someone converts from what was the previous page from where they converted to become, let's say, subscriber to the newsletter or anything else? For example, we have a sort of a freemium model, which is you have a free service, but we try to convert you slowly, nurture you, and then push you into the one of the two paid plans. But it's not always the case. For some businesses, the main priority is a call. Immediately, you need a call ASAP. So I would say my way of doing things is always, at least in the first week or two, if more is needed, that's fine. Just obsess over the data and try to find issues. And I mean all sorts of issues, from the top of the funnel all the way to the bottom. What channels are being used? What's the performance? And especially if there are data problems, whether that's the sources of data, where is the data stored, or there's like I don't know if you know this, but the most common problem, for example, is, and which is kind of absurd a little bit, is tracking. Wherever you go, I always find the same problem. Like the tracking is wrong. You would think everybody would be focused on tracking, make sure that it's solid, no errors, but it's not the case. And if you have tracking problems, my advice, put 110% into fixing it as soon as possible. So that's how. And then from that point onwards, I usually would go with Miro, and then I just create a huge board of everything that I found, and I start crafting my plan. Based on the resources, of course, sometimes you just cannot do what you want to do because there are limited resources, so you have to take that into account. But I would attack first the low-hanging fruits, and I can give you an example. In SEO, you go and you have, let's say, 5, 10, 15 keywords that rank from position 10 to 20. Those are low-hanging fruits. You go there, you improve the content, and those things rank in 2-3 months. So my strategy first and foremost is to attack the low-hanging fruits while we are working on the, let's say, not long-term, but like mid-term strategy, which I would say it's between 3 to 6 months. And that's usually how I divide it: 0 to 3 months, 3 to 6 months, and long-term 6+. But first you attack the low-hanging fruit so that you get the most possible in the shortest time possible.
I love that. You know, going for quick wins, I think, is always a good strategy, and it kind of clears away some of the things you can do and lets you focus on perhaps some of the more difficult tasks. I'm interested, when you're building a plan, do you look to use as broad a mix of tactics as possible, or do you feel that there are some primary tactics that really work well for you and that those are kind of your go-to things?
Yeah, that's an amazing question. I love that. I've been debating that with people in the industry for so long. I remember I was reading an article maybe of 2 or 3 months ago that said, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think that they said that email has 29-to-1 return on investment compared to paid advertising. I'm trying to say that if there's anything that has proven to never fail, is that you need to build up your email list. Now, I'm not saying that's the only way or the only focus, but if there is any channel that you can never fail if you do it right, is definitely the email. I mean, we always look for shiny object syndrome. So let's say what AI can do or what that can do or this can do. Email never fails. The average person opens their email at least 10 times a day. It's a channel that they prefer. It's a preferred method of communication, especially in B2B. I always use a broad approach. So I would split them between inbound marketing and outbound, see where we can go with cold. But the problem with cold outreach is that at some point it eventually just hits a wall, cannot scale more. You can always expand the persona or build a new one if you have different products. Some companies don't have that. If you're an electrician and I don't know, if you do something other on the side, yeah, maybe you can expand, and then instead of targeting just one group, you go after another. But if you're running just one product line or division, you certainly will hit a wall at some point. And then the question is, what now? But if you have an email list, I've heard people say that they don't like Google ads or Facebook ads or SEO, but if nobody has ever said that they regret having a good email list. There has never been such a case in history. So there's a reason for that. And it's a reciprocal relationship because you're giving something for free in exchange of their, you know, so they don't feel like you're selling something to them. You're nurturing them. So it's reciprocal. You're not asking for something while giving nothing in return. So as long as you provide something of value, of course, they're going to reciprocate. And that's something that I found that works crazy well, to be honest. I would never say that's the only strategy, far from it, but I'm saying if you're building your email list, by very definition, you also need to work on paid ads, conversion funnels, data, front end. Of course, you need to optimize the landing page, copywriting. It just carries with it 5-6 different, completely different areas, and lead gen, demand gen, all of that. It just creates so much work. But if you nail it, I'm doubting that anyone has ever said that they regret building their email list.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great advice. Obviously, the challenge is really building that list and getting the tactics right to encourage people to sign up. So I'm interested in how you do that, how you actually encourage people to fill in that form or hand their details over so you can actually add them to the list. Do you have approaches for that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Till 2020, most of the companies, both in B2C and B2B, use the one-step approach. So what you do is send them to a page. You try to create as much value as possible to the page in exchange for their information. This is public knowledge, but I'm going to share something with you. We have something called the breadcrumb approach, which is 20 steps. Our average landing page to lead currently is 35%. The average industry is like 4 or 5%. Of course, it requires testing. I'm not saying everybody should have 20 tests, but a good test would be like this. So let's say you have four elements on the form. So you have name, email, phone number, and I don't know, maybe something else, but let's say company email or whatever, so whatever is mandatory. But if you flip that with four steps, which means four separate steps, not all in one form, and then you ask first for the less intrusive one. So it could be like, what's your name? Or where do you work with? Or what's your age? Whatever, it's not an issue. So as long as a person commits more, it will psychologically make them commit further as you demand more personal things. So let's say their phone number or their email or maybe some company information. So what we generally use and what I would advise is that whatever is the most difficult thing to ask, leave it for last. So as long as they invest in the form, in our case was the select plan. So if you want, for example, let's say if you're running a B2C, this is the same actually with B2B, but if your conversion model is most of the sales happen within 0 and 3 days, for example. So you need them to convert fast. So how do you do that? So that's how you do it. You make them select a plan and at the last step while having them commit to 15 steps beforehand. And they're much less likely to abandon it if the investment is high. And the counterintuitive argument is something like, why would anyone bother to go through so many steps? The crazy part is that they would rather do that than just give you all the information into, let's say, a single page form with everything listed. And I've tested this so many times, and there has never been one case where the single page form outperforms the breadcrumb. So in B2B, you don't need 20 steps because nobody requires that kind of personalization. But if you find a way to split them, if from 1 to 5, 6, leave what you need the most last and test it. And I don't want to overpromise, but it works, honestly.
Well, I'm not sure we'll all get 35% conversion rate, but if we could all move it up from the low single digits, I think everyone would be happy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the key is to be better than yesterday, not follow some random industry average. Plus, the B2C is kind of a bit deceiving because you cannot measure the B2B and B2C investment in forms. In B2C, the last I saw, the average one is like 10%. In B2B, it's between 3 and 5. So just doubling that is more than enough.
That's great advice. I mean, I think that's interesting, and breadcrumbing is certainly something, you know, if people are not familiar with, they should look at. It's something that I know a number of guests have talked about on the podcast. Emir, I'm interested to look forward now. I mean, you've talked about what you're doing today. How do you see marketing changing over the next few years? I mean, is AI going to completely transform things, or is it going to stay, you know, much like it is today?
Yeah, that's if you look at now the main AI tool. So I don't know if you're familiar with Magix. It's a company out of Tel Aviv. I don't know. I don't want to sound biased, but in my opinion, they have the best marketing automation software for paid advertising. Maybe I'm biased. I've tried a couple of them. I really like them. I think the company was founded in Israel, if I'm not wrong, or in Austria. I think it was in Israel. It's actually an amazing software. And right now they even created something called Marketer AI. It's interesting because you don't see a lot of AI tools actually doing the thinking for you. So usually what AI is focused on is cutting your time. So what does it mean? So let's say if you are running a CRM or an email marketing software or ad creative AI powered software. So what they usually do is that they try to cut the manual work. What I'm trying to say is that what I see is that AI will certainly reduce the need for copywriters, for marketing research, anything that was previously done, not manually, but it requires human input to a much greater degree. Magix has one of their tools is actually that they give you recommendations based on your ad's performance, AI based. So it says, well, this was happening the last 7 days. I recommend that you do X or Y or Z. It doesn't matter. So it tries to replace the thinking process. Now that's revolutionary. So it's not just some task that they're trying to replace. As far as marketers focus on data interpretation, that cannot be easily replaced by AI. But as long as their primary focus is a task or very tight niche, so let's say link building outreach. Now, you can definitely improve that using AI. But if your focus is interpreting what happens once you get those links and how those links transform your rankings, that's not something AI can do. Or at least not as well as someone who is experienced can do. So my focus will be to simply focus on things that AI cannot replace, which is interpreting the result of your strategies and moving slowly away from things that are repetitive. So including even to an extent copywriting, because if almost every software out there now has an AI assistant so that you can churn out emails. And usually they're very well written. So it's not something that you can compete. And plus it cuts the cost for employers. That would be my advice. That's what I think that AI would definitely impact. And I don't think they will impact marketing jobs a lot because marketing is still a very creative industry. So it still requires a lot of human potential.
I think that's great insight to the future. And certainly, you know, everyone check out Magix. Can you just give the URL for that so the listeners can find it?
MADGICX.com.
Perfect. Now, I think people will want to check that out. So thank you for that. I mean, Emir, it's been really interesting, this discussion. You seem very positive about the future of marketing. I mean, presumably, if somebody was young, was thinking of entering the industry, came to you, you'd be, you know, quite keen for them to become a marketer. So I'm interested, what would be your advice as to how to successfully start a marketing career?
Probably the best advice that I could give them is that to, especially at the outset, to avoid working for big companies. And I know it sounds counterintuitive, but you will usually be just a hog in, like a hog in the machine, and you won't get enough exposure to real problems. So if you're starting out and all you're given is a task and you're not allowed to question the system, which is something that happens super often, you'll never get enough exposure to problems to grow as a marketer. And it creates a problem because AI will replace most of the repetitive things. So I'm not saying that, of course, every business is different and the system is different. How it operates is pretty much unique. My advice would be to find someone that is willing throw them in the fire and at least for the first couple of years to work for either a startup. And I know it's not very popular because startups can get really demanding and sometimes they don't have that the same kind of work-life balance. But starting out, I would definitely give that advice, because everybody who has worked for a big company, what they usually receive is a set of tasks they perform, not getting exposed to real problems so you can learn and grow. And even if you want to get exposed, you're not allowed to, because the system is already created. You cannot challenge it without creating a mess on four other different areas. So that would be my advice, to be honest. And the second one is to read a lot, especially understand data. It may sound crazy, but what I would advise them to do is that they take any channels, whether that's SEO, Google Ads, LinkedIn, doesn't matter, and try to understand the KPIs, read all of them, and understand how it impacts further down the funnel. So if you have, for example, let's say you have a lot of new visitors, but at the same time, your bounce rate goes up. So what does it mean? It means probably you're getting a lot of referral traffic. And that interpretation of the data I remember when I was reading one book about the CIA, it says, all the intelligence in the world means nothing unless you have someone to act on it. Like, you can have all the data, all the intelligence. If you don't know what it means, you cannot act on it. So it's meaningless, pretty much. The data doesn't do anything by itself.
I love it. I mean, that's brilliant advice. I mean, Amir, this has been fascinating. You've been very generous with your insight and your advice for people. I mean, if anyone's listening and they'd like to get in touch, what would be the best way to reach you?
Probably by LinkedIn. I mean, that would be one way. And via email, zetsuitsamir1994@gmail.com, which is my personal email.
Awesome. That's very generous. Amir, this has been fascinating. I really appreciate your time. Thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
It was a pleasure, and thank you a lot for the opportunity actually to be here.
Thanks so much for listening to Marketing B2B Tech. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and if you did, please make sure you subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast application. If you'd like to know more, please visit our website at napierb2b.com or contact me directly on LinkedIn.